UW-Madison Campus Voices mission is to capture, present, and preserve some of the strongest historical stories and memories of UW-Madison through the people who lived them. Campus Voices, a project of the UW-Madison Oral History Program, consists of presenting extant archival material in 21st century formats, such as a podcast, mini-movie, and iTunes album.
Welcome. I am Courtney Barnes, an intern with the University of Wisconsin Archives Oral History Program, and I will be hosting this podcast, which aims to tell the story of women working in science, engineering, and mathematics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison over the past century. Within this podcast, you will find firsthand accounts containing anecdotes of the struggles that female researchers have overcome while conducting science, math, and engineering research at the University of Wisconsin between the 1920s and the present day. As a female engineering student who will be entering the workforce in the near future, this topic hits home for me, as I'm sure it will for many others. I would like to thank Tracy Nathans-Kelly of the Engineering Professional Development Department and Troy Reeves of the Oral History Program for providing me with the opportunity to explore this topic. In the early part of the 20th century, women that were married to another university faculty member faced unique challenges while conducting scientific research. The careers of many female researchers in science, engineering, or mathematics depended on the influence of their husbands. Ethel Allen was the wife of Oscar Allen, a professor of bacteriology in the 1920s. While she was not employed by the UW, she was able to conduct her own scientific research alongside her husband in the lab.
I could work in the department, not in any paid position, but I could help my husband, as everybody in the department would say, are you here helping your husband?
Well, I was here. You know, by that time, that must have been pretty unusual to have people coming into the lab and not being part of the paid staff.
That's right, too. And I wasn't helping my husband. Heck, I was helping myself. You know, I was with him, and we could have lunches together.
Assistant Professor Elizabeth Hirschfelder worked in the mathematics department between 1931 and 1953. Her husband, Joe Hirschfelder, also worked in the same department. He requested that the department terminate her appointment in order to fit his needs.
Well, after we were married...
This is you and Joe Hirschfelder.
Yes. Joe was very anxious that I should be free to do things when he wanted. He did a lot of traveling, giving lectures and so on. And in fact, he had in mind the fact that he had piled up quite a collection of places that they wanted him to come. So he went to Mark Ingram and said, how about firing Betty? And Mark said, if you want to get her to stop teaching, it's up to you to go. I'm not going to fire her. So I did stop. And you see, we were married in 1954. And in 1957, we went on this six-month trip. We started by, Joe gave lectures in Hawaii and then on to Japan and India and to Europe. So this was quite a trip.
Wage gaps that exist between genders were especially prominent in the early to mid-1900s before federal legislation, such as the Equal Pay Act of 1963, was enacted. Margaret Irwin, who was associated with the UW intermittently between 1932 and 1951, relates her experience of wage discrimination to interviewer Donna Taylor.
There has been discrimination against women. They haven't received the salaries that the men have for exactly the same work very often. Don't you think that's true often?
It would seem to be. Did you feel this while you were working at the university?
I didn't mind the money, actually, because I didn't really need it.
But were you aware that you were not getting equal pay, so to speak?
Yes, definitely. I was aware that because I had a husband on the staff, I wasn't getting a salary that I would normally have commanded. But somehow, In my generation, we didn't fight that.
You assumed this was just the way it was.
Another example of equal pay issues was shared by Nancy Wygand. She describes the mid-1970s experience where she realized that she wasn't being compensated equal to her male peers, and the steps that she took in order to correct this discrimination.
So I think the first time that I felt that I was discriminated against was in this job I had for the Center for Health Sciences, where I'd worked for quite a while. And they hired a new person who was a guy, and he was a very chatty person, so I got to know him. And he told me how much he was earning, and I just about fell over because I was training him. I had written the software to be used for the medical school, and I guess it was so successful, or just, you know, not necessarily the software, but just the whole program that the director was doing. So the nursing school wanted to do the same thing. So the person I was working for hired this man to do the same thing for the nursing school. So I was training him. So when I found out he was making so much more than what I was making, and then I think that's when I was very upset. And then I think that's when I first found out that there were these different categories of jobs, you know, that some had benefits, some didn't have benefits. And I didn't really know anything about that. So when I found out that he was making so much more, I wanted to get back pay from the day that he started, and I wanted to get at least equal pay from what he was making. So I took this to to my immediate supervisor, and that didn't, you know, they didn't know what to do. So I actually went to and talked to some dean at the medical school or something, because I thought it was entirely unfair. So the arrangement they settled on was that I could get time off, and they would pay me that way.
Okay.
And then also change my position to be what was called, I believe, an academic staff specialist, a position that would have vacation included, because I had never had any paid vacation, and that would also be on the retirement system.
Okay.
So that's the way it was resolved. So I took some time off that next spring and summer, and still got paid, and that until the money equaled out.
Okay. Now, when you talked to your supervisor and to these other administrators, were they sympathetic?
Well, they couldn't argue. They couldn't. I mean, it was just plain facts. So
okay.
They didn't give me a hard time. They didn't. You know, they just said they didn't have to say that much. They said, "Well, how can we make this better?" You know. So.
Okay. So were you happy with the way the situation was resolved, or did you still feel...
At the time, I was happy, but I think that was the first a realization that nobody was looking after me. And I realized that maybe I need to look after myself, which I had never done before. I was lucky that when I was an undergrad and I was working at this instructional research laboratory, that the director there was so friendly and so caring that he would... you know, give me raises or whatever, and I never asked for anything. And it wasn't actually in my nature, and also I didn't grow up to be thinking that I'm supposed to be, you know, asking for more or promoting myself. I mean, I never learned that. Mm. And so, and I was protected before then. And then I think, so the mid-70s was when I started to realize that I really should start looking out for myself a little more.
Discrimination often comes from superiors, as in the case of equal pay. But peer-to-peer bias has followed women studying science or engineering as well. Monica Turner shares her experience of how it was unpopular for a girl to succeed in academics during the 1960s.
My mom was telling me recently that she remembered me not liking biology class at all when I was in high school, and she was really surprised that I ended up really wanting to major in biology as a college student, because she just didn't remember me having much, really liking it much at all.
Do you remember any of it?
I don't remember it very well, to be honest. I think in high school I was, actually the interesting anecdote, which I have shared with other people about high school, is just at that age, I had been a very good student all the way through, and then you get to be a teenager, and at least for girls at my high school and at my age, being smart was not something that was respected, at least amongst your peer group. And I placed my grades for the first few years of high school so that I would purposefully answer things wrong on tests so that I wouldn't get too high a grade. And I would keep the grade high enough not to get in trouble at home, but low enough that I would not be embarrassed with my, you know, with my peers, which is just kind of crazy. So I used to get my grades kind of in the high 80s where I would be sort of safe. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things I mostly remember from, you know, in terms of academic behavior and such. And
Ann Burgess was a UW student in the early 1960s. Her experiences showed that women studying science may not have felt a sense of belonging.
Now there's all these learning communities and women in science and engineering dorm and things like that. I think it's so wonderful, and I'm so glad they're doing that. Because I do remember feeling very isolated in the dorm. I lived in Chadron Hall the first 2 years. It was all women's dorm at that time. Though back in those olden days, they segregated the men and the women. Mm-hmm. And if I had a question about a chemistry problem, there wasn't anybody around that I could just go work with. Whereas in the men's dorm, lots of people were. And I didn't know anybody well enough to call them up and do it on the phone. So. Mm-hmm. I didn't even realize at the time, I was very isolated, but I didn't realize it at the time. Mm-hmm. The other thing I do remember, though, is people treated me as weird because I was a chemistry major.
Other women students, you mean, or any students?
Everybody.
Everybody.
And I belonged to a sorority, and we used to have to go to these things called beer suppers that I just hated. I hated those things, but it was required to go. So the sorority and the fraternity would get together for this Friday night dinner. And some fraternity guy would come up to me and start a conversation, and then pretty soon he'd ask me what I'm majoring in, and when I said chemistry, usually he'd just turn around and walk away. So anyway, that's the atmosphere of chemistry. And while I'm talking about sororities, anybody that got engaged, they had this huge ceremony. Everybody was I can't remember how they called us to the living room, but it'd be a darkened living room, and you'd pass around a candle, and the person who got engaged blew out the candle, and oh, it was such a big deal. I got a fellowship to Harvard, and it wasn't a big deal to anybody. And I just remember thinking how ironic.
At the university, tenure discrimination has been prominent over the years. This discrimination may begin as early as the assignment of research topics or the expectations of tenure track staff, and it often continues through the tenure application process. Marian Namenworth discusses her experiences at the university, which culminated in tenure discrimination during the 1970s.
I think the phenomenon probably existed. I'd heard about it in theory. I'm not so sure I saw evidence of it. That faculty sponsors were more concerned about the viability of men's careers. So, for example, pushing them towards particular research topics, they were more likely to saddle women with topics that might not yield in the short run, or, you know, that the things that were worth doing that the professor wanted done, but which probably wouldn't have a splashy result and which would therefore make it harder for them to get a good job.
Okay.
Whereas they would be more protective of men's long-term interests in such selections. I didn't expect any discrimination at all against women. These people seemed to me to be very reasonable and kind of liberal, progressive types on the whole, and well-meaning, and the whole idea of discrimination was silly, and they thought it was silly, and, you know, that they thought of themselves as entirely focused on the quality of research and teaching and the quality of thinking, and I agreed. So I didn't expect when I went there to see any signs of discrimination at all. But as I was there and saw the way that the tenure system worked in practice, I mean the way the system worked of treating people and giving them opportunities before tenure and then evaluating them for tenure, it was obvious to me that it was not even-handed, comparing the way women and men were treated. And so I you know, I think to a considerable extent this was unconscious on the part of the faculty in their decisions. I think they believed in what they were doing. But, you know, this was, as time passed, women and society in general became conscious of a lot of ways that biased decisions are made that are not exactly intentional. Some of these things you had to see it in action to understand it. For example, one thing that I learned, one thing that was extremely helpful and was an example of the openness of the department, was of the zoology department, was that when I first came there in 71, they had decided that that the faculty discussions when somebody was considered for tenure were going to be open to all the faculty, including the non-tenured faculty.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result, I was able to sit in on the discussions for the whether two or three of the men ahead of me would become tenured. And from sitting in on those discussions, I got an idea about how the tenure considerations worked. Excuse me a minute. About how the, you know, what sorts of questions were debated in deciding whether to recommend tenure for an assistant professor.
Mm-hmm.
And what I saw was that one faculty member would take responsibility for shepherding the case through the faculty. You know, that person would carefully examine the record of the candidate and presumably have talked with them and have some idea about their strengths and weaknesses. And then that professor, of course, the candidate was not in the room, but
mm-hmm.
That professor would present that person's case to the rest of the faculty and kind of act as his lawyer, you know, acting on his behalf
mm-hmm.
and kind of defending him, or at least, you know, trying to explain the weaknesses and give a lot of attention to the strengths.
Yeah.
Now, when I came up for tenure, nobody was willing to take that position.
Hmm.
And part of the problem, and you know, having heard about this in the situations of other people too, I think part of the problem was that there was something sociologically embarrassing about taking up the cause of a woman.
Okay.
And so a problem was created in the structure of the way the tenure system was to work. And what was problematic about it was that there was no rule in the university that said one person shall act as the defender or lawyer or representative of the candidate. This is something that had developed informally.
Mm-hmm.
So that when nobody wanted to do it for a woman, nobody realized that this would, they weren't even so conscious that that's what usually happens, or
yeah.
that if it didn't happen for a woman, that this would create a problem in itself.
Yeah.
You know, so that's an example of one of the things which by the end of the 70s was, you know, a paradigmatic situation that universities realized they had to step in and deal with.
Okay.
And there were many things like that. Including, for instance, the tendency to give women a whole lot of teaching to do and then ask why they weren't doing so much research.
Okay.
There were many things like that that were sort of, you know, not exactly planned, but
okay.
they ended up in biased decisions. I was completely lulled into a, you know, through most of the 70s, I mean, until I came, you know, was rejected for tenure, I had been lulled into the feeling that things were very above board in that respect in the zoology department. For example, I realized that I was getting more pressure to do more teaching than the men were, but I expected that would be considered when they considered me for tenure. That you know, since they had loaded all this teaching on me, that they would realize that takes time and that, you know, the research articles that I published in that period would have to be balanced against, you know, what my teaching obligations were. It wasn't just there was also the phenomenon, and this is another one of these things that at this time universities had not realized they had to deal with, that if you are one of the few women on tenure track on the campus, in especially in science departments, that and if the school is under pressure to have women in positions of power, then you are asked to sit on a gazillion committees, mm-hmm. so that there will be a woman on the committee. And this happened to me too. And you know, being not too having, you know, not much insight into the situation, I agreed to do a whole lot of administrative work, you know, quite a bit more than men were expected to do. Thinking that yes, it was important to have women on these various committees, and you know, assuming that this would be taken into account in a reasonable way when mm-hmm. at the time of tenure evaluation, but you know, it wasn't. So, and this is a widespread phenomenon. So, I had been completely lulled by the fairness and even generosity that I had seen in the consideration of other assistant professors for tenure in the zoology department, which happened to be men, but I, you know, all of them, that's all there were. I'd been lulled into thinking that, you know, they would be even-handed and reasonable in evaluating my record, but, and so, when you say, did I feel I could lean on the Association of Faculty Women for backing, I wasn't really expecting to need backing.
Denise Denton was the first woman to be granted tenure in the College of Engineering at the University of Wisconsin. However, she faced much discrimination on the way to tenure and was initially denied a tenure appointment. Partially due to her tenure denial, she and others worked to create legislation to protect people from tenure discrimination.
There was a woman at UW-Milwaukee, mm-hmm. and I think she was in the business school there. And she'd been denied tenure, and by all appearances, she was better than three or four men in the same department who'd gotten tenure recently. Mm-hmm. And what we discovered was that the laws or whatever in the state of Washington were set up, Wisconsin, were set up in such a way that a department could vote no on a case. No, you know, deny tenure. Mm-hmm. And then in this, there was a case at UW-Stout or someplace, I think it was Eau Claire actually, where a black guy had been denied tenure by his department, but the regents and or the chancellor had granted him tenure. Mm-hmm. And then the department members had sued or, you know, grieved through some processes, and they won. And the judge in court said, look, given the laws in the state of Wisconsin, I have to find for the members of this department, but fundamentally I have to tell you that I think these rules are out of sync with, you know, Title IX or whatever.
Yeah.
Or, you know, equitable practices, because the bottom line was that the department could have basically said, we're voting against this guy because he's black. Mm-hmm. And the way the rules or the laws in Wisconsin were written, that couldn't be overturned.
Okay.
And so When a similar thing happened to Seal Pillsbury, we mobilized around her case a number of women in the state, and we got an elected official, and I don't remember who it was, to push to get that law changed.
Okay.
And they called it the Pillsbury Law or something.
Okay.
And it actually got changed so that there could be some oversight in tenure denials in a way that made sense. And we all ended up going to the signing. The governor, Tommy Thompson at the time, came over to one of the, you know, that UW the administration building on campus there for the
yeah.
whole system.
Van Hyde,
but anyway,
yes.
It was up in the top floor of that tall building.
Yes.
And he had a big signing ceremony, and we were all there.
Now, that meant that when a woman was denied, or a person was denied tenure, and it could be proved that it was unjust, what then happened?
You could now reverse it.
Okay.
Whereas before, apparently, it wasn't able to be reversed.
Okay.
By the people up on high.
The campus climate for women, especially women in science and engineering, has dramatically changed over the years. With a long way to go, women in science, engineering, and mathematics have come far at the UW in the past century. Elizabeth Craig, the current chair of the Department of Biochemistry, describes how the campus climate for women has changed since she arrived at UW in 1979.
I think the climate is not great, not bad. I think it's the climate is, I think this is a really complex issue. And, excuse me, one of the things I've struggled with over the last number of years is it's much easier if you're in a position as you're an advocate for, like, the climate is bad, the situation is bad, how can we make it better? And being in a situation of being a department chair where you have to be everyone's advocate. In some ways you can accomplish much more, but it's much harder to say, oh, the climate's terrible, or, oh, in part because you're part of it, perhaps. But so I think it is a very complex, a complex issue. I think it is much better than it was 25 years ago. Just in, like, there are more women. I mean, there were very few women in biological sciences when I came. I remember in cell and molecular biology program that had 103 trainers. I was the third woman as a trainer in that program. But that doesn't mean we don't have a long way to go.
As Elizabeth Craig stated, women studying science, engineering, and mathematics have come a long way over the years, but there are still barriers that need to be overcome. Hopefully this podcast helps to illustrate some of the progress that has been made over the years regarding gender equality in a traditionally male-dominated field. This podcast represents a small sample of the stories contained in several interviews maintained by the UW Archives and Records Management Oral History Program. For more information about the Women in Science and Engineering Project or other Oral History Program projects, please visit http://archives.library.wisc.edu.